Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And welcome to Free Exchange. I'm John Ashmore, the editor of CapEx. My guest this week is Tim Kaine, an entrepreneur, economist, Air Force veteran, and latterly a candidate for the US Congress. Tim is also the co-author with Glenn Hubbard of the acclaimed book Balance, The Economics of Great Powers from Ancient Rome to Modern America. I started our interview by asking him about the thesis behind his book and why it is great powers end up falling on hard times. So, Tim, welcome to Free Exchange. Thanks very much for being with us. Now, your kind of magnum opus, if you like, is a book called Balance with Glenn Hubbard.
Yes.
I mean, it's about the way that great economies decline, and you see that as something that comes not from necessarily from external threats, but from a kind of stasis and, you know, almost eating themselves from within. I mean, how would you explain your theory, and how did you set about proving it, if you like?
So we wanted to follow up on the 25th anniversary of Paul Kennedy's book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers. So the subtitle of our book is The Economics of Great Powers, and Paul's a historian, and Glenn and I are both economists. So we just start with the notion that we have better data than we did, than Paul had 25 years ago. And we all know now, I think, that GDP per capita is really the measure of productivity that's the go-to, and that defines our productivity frontier. And we use that as a starting point to define economic power. And then it's such a fun book, John. We'll go back in time to look at the British Empire, of course, the Roman Empire, the ancient Chinese.
Ottomans, I think, make an appearance.
The Ottomans, yeah, that's right. That was a lot of fun. So, but we included the British a bit cheekily because both Glenn and I think Britain's never really declined. It's been surpassed in some ways, but we would dispute the notion that that there was ever a collapse of the British Empire. And in fact, Britain, I like to say, is the first country that converted from being a great empire to a good nation, in that it did things against its own self-interest for values that it cared about, ending slavery in 1807. Nonetheless, Britons are prone to make mistakes, just like Americans are, and we warn that Paul's wrong when he says empires collapse due to imperial overstretch. That's just a bad idea. If you look at the Roman Empire, any other empire in history, it wasn't that it stretched too far that led to its demise. It was fiscal problems or monetary problems. The Romans debased their currency famously to the point where a silver coin had almost no silver in it. So led to massive inflation. The Spanish Empire also had bankruptcies, I think, 6 times in a century. So it's that internal chaos, that internal imbalance that I think threatens the United States and that we think will probably be the undoing of the EU, although, you know, I will take a grain of salt. We thought Greece wouldn't be in the EU at this point, and yet here it remains.
And can you pinpoint a kind of moment in each of those empires where that process begins, or is it so gradual and incremental that you can just say it happened over the course of decades or centuries?
I think it happens when a country shifts from conserving its values to conserving its material gains. So it's a bad sort of conservatism. They don't want to have dynamic change. They want to protect jobs, right? God forbid that we have the ditch diggers with their shovels lose out to tractors and you know, modern capital equipment. So we're capitalists. We're just unapologetic capitalists. We think capital growth is great. And to modernize the argument a little bit, this notion that AI is going to take all of our jobs, I mean, it's just this is such an old story, from the Luddites here in the United Kingdom to the saboteurs who sabotaged the British, I'm sorry, the French shoe factory. There's this worry that machinery takes jobs. Just because it's computerized machinery doesn't really update the theory at all. Capital equipment, as it expands, liberates labor. And when you become too cautious about that, that's the decline of a country. And the Romans famously did bread and circuses to sort of entertain their people, to sort of bribe them to be quiet.
And on this automation point, I think it sort of it ties in with a bit of a sort of eschatological worldview you see a lot. I mean, we're here in London this week, we've had massive protests, and it's this idea that we're all heading to catastrophe seems to have kind of reasserted itself.
Yeah.
In quite an interest. But, you know, that's been there throughout history. I mean, the Mayans would tell you that the world was about to end. I mean, is that something you see in these empires that you've studied as well?
I'm really confused by the hard left's environmentalism. It's. I think some people have argued that it's become a new form of religion, gives a sense of meaning. And, of course, there's an end times threat to it, like all good religions have. But as an economist, I keep saying, where's the harm? I'm not even denying that there's, you know, man-made global warming happening to some degree. I'm not sure how much. I think it's very controversial. But where's the harm? And it's articulating the harms which just haven't appeared, other than, well, the world will flood and we'll all drown, which makes no sense, right? Sea levels have already risen over the past century. Cities that are on the edge of the ocean tend to retreat back a bit. So capital equipment tends to atrophy and it gets replaced about every 30, 40, 50 years. Look at the construction here in London. There are new towers sprouting up and old buildings being torn down.
Oh, yeah. So
I just don't buy the harms, John. And to the extent I think it's been categorized that it could lead to 10,000 deaths. I mean, really, that's sort of a bad quarter in the United States. Death is part of life. But what I care more about is ending poverty in Africa. To me, that's a much bigger priority than the sort of make-believe harms of global warming. And there are other environmental issues that get neglected. Plastics in the oceans, I care a lot about. Dolphins being killed and poison toxins in water. Those, to me, get completely neglected by the religion of global warming.
And obviously something that came up in Michigan, not too far from your own home state.
Flint.
Yeah.
Yeah, you followed that story, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to come back to balance, can you see the ideas that you and Glenn came up with? How would you apply them to the world at the moment? I mean, you've talked about America and the EU. I mean, how does it manifest itself in terms of that decline? Is it because America's got huge national debt? Is it because it's over-consuming?
Right.
There's too much personal debt?
Absolutely. We're living in a really bizarre time monetarily. I think everyone knows that. In the United States, the federal government alone is spending $1 trillion more than it brings in revenues. And in a $20 trillion economy, you know, that's roughly 5% of the economy year after year after year that it's spending that it doesn't have the revenues for. And we have the most serious candidates on the left, Elizabeth Warren, calling for, you know, just completely unsustainable programs. And she'll say they'll be paid for with a wealth tax, very destructive. And it won't nearly accommodate her spending ambitions. So the unseriousness of the serious candidates on the left and even on the right, Trump's running $1 trillion deficits. It's very frustrating. The bill will come due, and this is our warning in the book that this has happened before. I would flip it a little bit to the current British situation in that we're ultimately optimists. And I'm an optimist about the United States and its great prosperity because we have a flexible, dynamic society. We have 50 states. I think what's occurred in the last 5 years with the explosion of populism is that most democracies now have two parties. One is a nationalist party, which is said sneeringly, and the other is a globalist party. And I think all of our parties, and this is true in the U.S., we've lost a sense of federalism. And that's why I think the EU is problematic, that it robs the sovereignty with a sort of regulatory heavy hand of Britain. And when you lose state flexibility to experiment with different economic institutions, then you're going to slow down your economy when there's just one common standard that you know, there's no such thing as perfection in governance, right? There's progress, but there's not perfection.
Now, what do you think the way forward for the EU? I mean, there are a lot of people in the UK probably who don't really care because they want to be out and, you know, cast their own path. But looking at the EU from the outside, what do you think the best way forward for them, you know, or is it just that they're going to have to manage decline? Famous phrase.
No, that's a great question. I've one of the things we did in the book, John, which I'm most proud of, is that we tried to break out of the idea that there is a spectrum of capitalism, with the cowboy capitalists in the United States compared to the Soviet-style socialists, and that there are many flavors of market economies here in Europe. And we said there are at least three supermodels. There's the Nordic model, which is the wealthiest and the freest. There's the central model, which includes Germany and UK, which are poorer, actually, just slightly. And then there are the southern European economies, which involve very heavy-handed states, profligate spending, large debts. And they're, on average, about 50% of GDP per capita of the frontier, the U.S. economy presently. They've also got massive unemployment, and yet the most protected labor. So, you know, there are lessons there that, that should be preserved. And I think the danger is the EU is sort of squelching that and trying to impose one common fiscal standard and maybe ultimately common labor rules. So that's what we're pushing back against. I think that the allure of the EU is we've got free trade. We're a commercial union, but it became so much more than that, a monetary union, a regulatory union, and a migratory no limits on what migration might happen. There's one refugee policy, even when there could be ties to terrorism. So I think that's rightly what many British said. Can we just go back to the fiscal and monetary? And from my eyes over on the other side of the Atlantic, the Brussels doesn't want that to happen. It's all or nothing. You know, can't we just go back to being friends? And they're saying, no, no, it's the marriage. It's the whole kit and caboodle.
It's kind of the tragedy of the EU is it had... in the 80s, you know, the sort of Thatcherite idea of a single market,
right,
the potential to be a great force for economic liberalism, and now it's kind of gone the other way. I mean, do you see something that echoes previous eras in the way that we talk about, you know, the vested interests building up these kind of relations and sort of, what can I say, regulatory capture has happened in a big way.
Yeah, monopoly power is a real thing. Monopolies don't give a damn about progress. They don't want small startup companies disrupting their highly profitable enterprises. So absolutely. And that's an issue that governments need to constantly be on guard against. And I think it's part of our balance hypothesis that when you get a fusion of special interest capitalism or special interest democracy, you're really on the path to decline.
It's the same in the States, really. I mean, I've looked on this website and it lists everyone who's worked in the federal regulatory agencies and then gone on and then worked in the industry that they were previously regulating.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons that I stopped working on tax policy because I saw so many people get on the treadmill of become a tax policy expert for the government, and then 5 or 10 years later you're a lobbyist or you're working for a big bank or, you know. So you write the laws and then you go sell your knowledge to the companies that can most advantage it, which is why, you know, flat, simple taxes are the only way to go to maintain a strong economy.
I mean, you ran as a Republican last year in your home state.
Oh, no, you found out.
I mean, do you think you're a bit of an outlier in the current Republican Party in the way that you are sort of avowedly free trade?
I think like most people that listen to think tank podcasts, I'm iconoclastic. I have views that don't always fit into, you know, neat boxes. So, you know, I hope we're all outliers. I tried to emphasize that I'm a, you know, pro-trade, pro-immigration Republican. He made the joke that I was from the Republican wing of the Republican Party, that old Reaganite Bush view of the world. And that is out of step with this new populism.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And what do you think you're a specialist on immigration, particularly, and the story of America and much of its progress is people coming with nothing and making something of themselves. And do you think that cultural value is under threat now, or is this going to dissipate once we have a different president?
The immigration debate, unfortunately, went through what's happened to all modern debates is, are you a racist or not? So which side are you on? When it's not really about race, it is about this really wonderful heritage we have in the United States as being open to immigration. The founding president, George Washington, said his ambition was that the United States would be the asylum to the world. We're a long cry from that now, and people's attitudes. Although I've done a public opinion polling to emphasize the American people are still very pro-immigration. It's just the debate among the political class has become so polarized, as so many of them have. So no, as a country, we still are very open. We're the number one country in the States in terms of bringing in 1 million legal immigrants per year. Mm-hmm. That's by far the most common path. The population of illegals has been stable for about 15 years, so there was a bubble of Mexican labor that came up. But Mexico's prospering because of the free trade agreement. So I think the lesson that I'm trying to take now with my work on immigration is this. What's the great threat we face? And some people really emphasize terrorism, I think wrongly. Terrorism is a persistent threat, but it's not an existential threat. Whereas great power competition with an authoritarian model in China, that's the threat we face. And how do we win against them through the lens of immigration? You know, we should be welcoming every Chinese scientist, every refugee out of Hong Kong. I would, if Trump were smart, he'd say, everyone in Hong Kong, you're welcome to come here and be a U.S. citizen because, you know what, you're a refugee right now. You have a repressive government cracking down on you. That would be brilliant and really make the world take notice.
And it's something, actually, a lot of Hong Kongers have this kind of strange limbo nationality where they're British nationals brackets overseas. Mm-hmm. So, again, I completely agree. I think our government could do a strike a blow for freedom and offer some of them full nationality.
I think it's such a smart idea, and it really would reframe the way people think about China. Because I'm against a trade war with China. I don't think that helps them, and it doesn't help us. More trade, I still believe, and this is iconoclastic, more trade with repressive countries helps liberate and free those countries. It's a slow process, but it works.
That was going to be my next question, is how much do you buy into this idea, speaking of China, that prosperity will beget a middle class that wants democracy and civil rights? Because it doesn't seem to have happened yet, but then again, they're not actually out of the middle income trap.
No. Even their average income in China is still, I think, about somewhere between one-fifth and one-seventh of the U.S. level. There is a middle class. There's also, as what happens with most societies that go through rapid growth, the Korean model, the Japanese model, there tend to be a concentration of wealth early in that development process. But there is a middle class developing. They are exposed to ideas. They're touring around the world. I'm sure you've seen a surge of Chinese tourism here in London.
Every single day.
Yeah.
Here in Westminster. We're right next to Westminster Abbey, so I see masses and masses of tourists.
And they're coming here and they're learning about the history of a free society, I mean, the birthplace of democracy. I think people are impatient with development, political development. And I think when China realized back in, let's say, the year 2001 and 2002, that 90% of the students that were going abroad were staying abroad. So, you know, let's encourage more Chinese students to come to the British universities and American universities.
Yeah, I mean, that's something you see even in schools now. There's entire schools that almost all the pupils in the UK are Chinese. Yep. So who knows, maybe we're sowing the seeds for a more democratic China.
I think
through
we
our education system.
Absolutely.
Now, just to do a little shout-out for a project we're doing here at CAPEX, we have a series about illiberalism in Europe, and I think your work kind of touches on a lot of the issues that have been raised there. I mean, what do you see, surveying the continent, as you've suggested, you know, there's lots of different models there, but are there any countries you look at and think, that's going down a really bad path? I'm thinking of places like Hungary, for example.
Mm. I haven't followed the European scene as closely. I think the one point that I usually come back to is the success stories, where Americans are finally waking up decades later that Sweden is not a socialist utopia. They shed that skin a long time ago, and they're economically very free. Bernie Sanders, our famous socialist candidate for president, said we should have an economy that's more like the Nordics, where they have high minimum wages, and yet most of the Nordic countries don't have any minimum wage at all.
Yeah.
So they have greater labor freedom. So I look a little bit more at the Nordic success stories and their embrace of economic freedom. I'm still really deeply worried about Spanish unemployment rates and Italians' instability. And I think the refugee crisis has only stressed out those economies more. But, John, I'm sure you know more about it than I do.
But I think from what you're saying, it sounds as though a lot of coverage tends to concentrate on whether you call it populism, nationalism, some people call it fascism, rise of Orban. But perhaps what you're saying is that the deeper underlying structural problems are maybe more of an issue in the longer term.
Yeah, very much so. We're in the U.S. The minimum wage is a national fight for a $15 minimum wage. Thank God right now it's being adopted in states and cities where it's turning out to be disastrous. In Seattle, for example, they adopted it. The city commissioned their own report that came back months later and said, yeah, we've lost jobs because of this policy. Poor people are losing jobs because you're pretending that you get to control wages. You can't. Governments can't control wages. Only prosperity leads, or prosperity and economic growth in a dynamic economy will get you more pay for the poorest.
I mean, what do you think when you look at the US now? I mean, the growth rates are pretty good, but is it slightly artificial because it's been kind of, the economy has slightly been pump primed by all this borrowing?
This is the hardest question for me, John, because it is partly artificial, but it's also partly very real. So I'm an optimist about the IT industry, and I think Google and Facebook are offering real value, and they're often demonized. They're not perfect. There were certainly warping societies. I see iPhone addiction in my own family. Dare I say, I get a little addicted myself. So, you know, we're evolving with technology, but it's a very positive story. And to the younger generation doesn't understand what it's like to lose touch with great friends and even family. And then suddenly these new technologies have given us value. It's very hard to measure in dollar terms. But, a united world means children in Africa are learning to read. They're able to use their phones to access the world's knowledge. I mean, it's hard to realize how fundamentally transformative and positive that is from, you know, the year I was born, in the 1960s.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because the day we're recording this podcast, the front page of the Times, I'll just grab it, says, Britons were happier when Victoria was on the throne.
Oh, no. That's such nonsense.
It's truly ridiculous. I mean, those kind of happiness indexes always make me, indices, I should say, they always make me kind of raise my eyebrows, because I think if you plonk down a Victorian into the modern age, their mind would explode.
that's the only problem, is the exploding minds.
Yeah, I mean, it's the hedonic adaptation problem, isn't it?
Yes.
You just...
So, and psychologists maybe shouldn't be in this business. So I think we economists need to reassert ourselves. Happiness is stable over time, right? So you have a significant negative emotional event, your happiness will come back to parity. Or a positive event, you get married, have a child, your happiness level goes back. That's the psychology. The question we have to answer is, you know, is society better off or worse off? Thomas Piketty famously said that the poor are just as poor in 2010 as they were in 1910. That's a direct quote from his book. And then he said, after a century of quote-unquote progress, the middle class got nothing but crumbs. Really? So in 1910, women couldn't vote. It doesn't show up in GDP, but I think, if I can say women are happier, and frankly, men are happier to have a more equal society. There certainly weren't civil rights in the U.S. There were lynchings of African Americans. In 1910, one out of 100 women died on the day of childbirth. I think they're happier now to be alive, and so are the husbands and the families. So the, just the health improvements, the inventions of air conditioning, the reduction in disease, these are all things that have increased the value of our lives, if not our happiness, and we should recognize that.
And some of your work, I mean, at the moment, is about these intangible things. You mentioned civil rights. You can talk about the environment as well. But I just want to pick you up on the idea of GDP as a measure of economic progress, because it's kind of the best we've got, but it's a bit like democracy is the best apart from all the others.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned Facebook and iPhones, and I think about the dematerialization you get from that, and the fact I haven't bought a CD in about 10 years.
What's
CD?
That? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I see. Sorry. Been out-bantered by this. Do you think do economists need to set their eyes a bit more firmly on this? And because it has huge implications for things like, we always say we're in a productivity crisis, but if actually we're misrecording GDP, then it could be that we're not in a growth crisis or a productivity crisis, we're just in a measuring crisis.
Yeah, I had a good friend who retired from the military. I served briefly, and he served a full career in the U.S. Air Force. And then he retired, and he was on a pension, and he decided he really wanted to relax in Hawaii. And then we had a conversation a few months later, and he complained about all the income inequality. I'm like, Steve, you chose to go to Hawaii and paddle around on a lower retired income, and you're living the quality of life. So people make choices in a free society, and inequality is okay. I think as long as there's protection of rights and freedoms, and I think there are some things that get to provide a baseline of income or health protection that are great. But as a liberal, you can't criticize GDP.
Liberal in the U.S. sense.
Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't be a progressive or a Democrat or a left winger and criticize GDP as this measure that doesn't include things, and then turn around and say, and look how poorly it's distributed. It's unfair.
Right.
You can't have your inequality cake and eat it as well, one or the other.
And I think another related issue, of course, is that we're not measuring equality of consumption. So if you just look at incomes, you're not getting benefits or health or anything like that.
Yep. Yeah, that's a very sophisticated take on it, and the measurement of consumption inequality is much flatter than income inequality. But the most ridiculous complaint is wealth inequality. Like, oh, the concentration of wealth, and the poor have so little wealth. Well, the poor have access to credit, credit cards and bank loans and automobile loans and student loans. Should we ban those so that there's no negative wealth in the poor? I mean, when I grew up, my parents were poor and they had access to credit. Thank God we were able to afford a home. So wealth inequality is a completely misleading statistic.
And just to round things off, Tim, we've talked a lot about interesting theoretical points, but I'm going to ask you for a run-of-the-mill political prediction. What's going to happen in November 2020?
Oh, in the U.S. elections.
In the U.S. elections. The presidential one. I'm not going to ask you to name every Senate and House.
Yeah, let's start with Alaska, John. I'd say this about the U.S. elections in 2020. I anticipate the Democrats are overreaching on this impeachment nonsense. I think there's been a politicization of the intelligence community, and I'm a former intelligence officer. It's really dangerous territory, and I think Americans are going to reject that. That said, my chips predictively are on Joe Biden still. I think Joe Biden wins the Democratic nomination and he wins the presidency. That's not who I'm voting for. It's not who I'm rooting for. I'd still like to see a low-tax conservative government that puts conservative Supreme Court justices on the bench in place.
Do you think that's just a function of the electoral college system and the way it stacks up? For the Republicans have to win pretty much all the swing states
I've studied the electoral college so intensively. I think it's one of the geniuses of American democracy, and where each state has to be won. You can't just win the national vote. And no, it's very easy for Democrats to win the Electoral College. They just keep bungling it. I mean, the great ideological message of the 2016 election isn't Trumpism, because he didn't get a majority of the votes of Americans. It's incompetence of the Democratic candidate in her campaign?
Well, on that happy note, we're going to leave it. So Biden 2020, even if you're not necessarily that happy about it.
That's
well, Tim, thanks very much indeed for joining us.
You bet, John. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.